introduced seeking to escalate tensions. I know of no bills that have been introduced seeking to relax or manage them. And so until the Democratic Party wakes up, there will be no one in Washington who will be able to resist this. And I think they might wake up when it's too late.
And I wanted to ask you, how do progressives and supporters of human rights, how are they able to support the or oppose the crackdowns on democracy activists in Hong Kong and the actions of China against the Uyghurs, while at the same time opposing the belligerence and the confrontational policies toward U.S.-China relations?
Sure. So, you know, I think anyone who wants to see a world that isn't defined by a new Cold War needs to take the direction that China has headed under Xi Jinping very seriously. I mean, I think I lived in Hong Kong for a year after the national security law took effect, and I saw from my own eyes how civil society that had long existed in that city was being smothered slowly, day after day. In Xinjiang as well, we've seen a massive, what I would consider a crime against humanity, take place. But at the end of the day, we need to be able to walk and chew gum at the same time. We need to be able to say, look, China, Beijing is increasingly brutal in how it treats places like Xinjiang and Hong Kong and also Taiwan. At the same time, the kind of escalatory path that we are headed on offers no future for the world. And also, I would add that while the West and Washington are not to blame for China's actions in Xinjiang and Hong Kong, when you have this overwhelmingly unified nationalist message that Washington is embracing around confronting China, this reinforces the same chauvinistic nationalist forces in China itself. And, that can contribute to an environment where China does continue to crack down in places like Xinjiang and Hong Kong. You know, I would say going forward, we need to kind of have this, have a Hippocratic oath. We need to find the best ways of adapting and mitigating the kind of rights abuses that China is doing without making the situation worse. And I'll give you one example. In the Strategic Competition Act that the Senate passed, there are calls to liberalize America's visa policy towards Hong Kong. And this, to me, would be a significant step. Steps that countries like Australia, the UK, Canada have already taken and have more robust policies towards. At the same time, you know, there's also provisions in the bill that seek to allocate a couple million dollars to promoting democracy in Hong Kong. You know, avoiding this kind of outward appearance of interfering in what China views as its core internal affairs is, you know, we need to avoid doing stuff like that, because it only, securitizes Hong Kong in the eyes of Beijing, and it only contributes to, it only provides further justification for people like the Hong Kong Security Force to crack down in Hong Kong. And so I think we need to think about how, we can adapt to China's growing rights abuses and the inevitability of its power without doing further harm to those we're trying to help.
That's Ethan Paul, research associate at the Quincy Institute for Responsible Statecraft. We'll link to his article, Biden Doesn't Understand the New Cold War. To see part one of our discussion, go to democracynow.org. Democracy Now! Is currently accepting applications for two full-time jobs, a director of finance administration and a human resources manager. Go to democracynow.org. I'm Amy Goodman. Stay safe, wear a mask, save lives.
Marley, and you're listening to WRCT in Pittsburgh, you know, go Steelers.
This is Law and Disorder.
Today on Law and Disorder, we interview Paul Jay for the full hour to discuss his investigative work about the attacks of September 11th, 2001.
Paul Jay has been following the 9/11 story for 20 years. He's read the documents. He's interviewed the key players in it. He tells a story that I think the listeners will be extremely interested in hearing.
Stay with us.
I'm New York City attorney and author Michael Stephen Smith.
And I'm New York City attorney and activist Heidi Boghossian. This is Heidi Boghossian with an op-ed that I wrote last week for the Los Angeles Times. WhatsApp has become a lifeline for humanitarian aid and preserving ties between families torn asunder, making last week's hours-long shutdown of the app, alongside other Facebook products, more than a mere inconvenience. Among Lebanon-Syrian refugee households in 2017, 84% used WhatsApp to relay their needs to international organizations. The UN Development Program notes that real-time data shared by immigrants through the app is invaluable in bringing humanitarian aid to those in crisis, allowing continued communication between WhatsApp contacts after border crossings and with new phone numbers. Notices of safe zones or food and aid distribution points are shared rapidly. When Facebook acquired WhatsApp for $19 billion in 2014, it knew the dollar-making potential of the messaging app. Antitrust lawsuits filed last December by the FTC and 48 attorneys general alleged that the social network bought the app as part of a strategy to knock out threats to its monopoly. What Facebook has since neglected is the public service that WhatsApp provides to its over 2 billion international users. WhatsApp became a go-to communications mode worldwide, in part due to the founder's commitment to user privacy, which is also in jeopardy. As the reach of this cross-messaging mobile platform extends, so does Facebook's responsibility to ensure it provides reliable, secure, an uninterrupted service. When a private telecommunications service provider performs what amounts to a critical public function, as in the case with WhatsApp, it should owe a duty of care to operate for the benefit of the public rather than purely for profit. Precedent for this exists in Federal Communications Commission rules applying privacy requirements of the 1934 Communications Act to broadband and other telecommunications service providers. While Facebook is not a public utility, California has recognized the need for backup plans in the communications marketplace. As of 2020, the California Public Utilities Commission required cell towers to have 72 hours of backup power in emergency situations, including electricity shutoffs during fire seasons. By beating out competitors to rapidly grow its users base, Facebook's family of apps, Facebook, Instagram, Facebook Messenger, and WhatsApp, has amassed a reported more than 3.5 billion active users monthly. In return, the company should make every effort to ensure continuity of WhatsApp, which has been connecting billions of users, many mired in precarious life conditions. For both users and anyone who cares about communication access, it's maddening to know that Facebook could have avoided the massive October 4th outrage that crippled WhatsApp, Instagram Messenger, and Oculus, its virtual reality arm. Facebook engineers reported in an update last week that, quote, a faulty configuration change on our end to backbone routers that coordinate network traffic between our data centers disrupted communication and halted services. There is a fix. Facebook should decentralize its internet technology architecture and put in place fallbacks and redundancies. The company's domain name servers, and the DNS is often referred to as the phone book of the internet for giving users access to online information, were all within Facebook's own network. Had Facebook kept some of these servers in the cloud through an external DNS provider, they could have been easily accessed when internal ones logged out technicians. And instead of their global control plane, that's one management point for all of Facebook's global resources, localized control planes could have allowed apps to work in different corners of the globe while some were offline. If Facebook fails to rise to the occasion on its own, the FCC and the FTC should jointly enact rules to hold the business accountable for avoidable service lapses. Congress should not stand in their way. A different remedy many may suggest is for users to simply go elsewhere and switch to other apps. But WhatsApp has already become a crucial public service, and leaders in other countries are recognizing that the private sector owes a responsibility to the public in comparable human rights situations. The French National Assembly, in 2017, for example, adopted a corporate duty of vigilance law. It makes it compulsory for large French companies to create a diligence plan, listing measures to identify and prevent human rights and environmental risks associated with their activities. The law builds on standard due diligence requirements in the UN Guiding Principles on Business and Human Rights. Averting future shutdowns that impact vulnerable communities in things such as accessing humanitarian aid should be built into Facebook's cost of doing business. Facebook is staring down intense scrutiny. After sharing that the company resisted changes to make the platform less divisive, whistleblower Frances Haugen recently said Facebook has repeatedly shown it operates for profit over safety. It already chased away millions of users this past January by updating WhatsApp's terms of service in a way that concerned users around their privacy protections, which the FTC had required Facebook to preserve when it initially acquired the app. At this juncture, the company itself, or more likely government regulation, needs to change course to protect democratic communication around the world.
The events of 9/11 were a crushing blow to democracy and the rule of law in our country. The attacks paved the way for two illegal wars, first the American war against Afghanistan and then Iraq. It opened the way for the national security state to develop expansively and implement a vast surveillance program on American citizens. The attack on the World Trade Center and then on the Pentagon happened 20 years ago, and in retrospect, was a turning point in American and world history. Law and Disorder Radio was launched 3 years after 9/11. Our mission was to defend both democracy and the rule of law. The 9/11 attacks were a crime against humanity, but instead of treating them as a crime, it was turned into an occasion to launch aggressive and illegal wars. The Nuremberg trials against the Nazis, who started World War II, defined aggressive war as the ultimate crime because it held within it all lesser crimes. In our show today, we examine the new evidence on who was responsible for the attacks on 9/11. The new evidence is a six-year-old FBI report released on President Biden's order last month. Biden was told by the families of the victims of 9/11 that unless this report was released, he would not be welcomed at any of the memorial services. The FBI report demonstrates the complicity of the government of Saudi Arabia in the attacks. It was two Saudi Arabian government officials that helped the first two hijackers when they came to America. They were given money and help to get into flight school. Then they hijacked an American airline plane and flew it into the Pentagon.
Senator Bob Graham was the head of the Intelligence Committee that investigated 9/11. Whistleblower Thomas Drake was a top official at the National Security Agency. Lawrence Wilkerson was the chief of staff for Secretary of State Colin Powell. We speak today in a special one-hour show with journalist Paul Jay, who interviewed all three of them. Paul Jay is a journalist and a filmmaker. He's the founder and host on the website as theanalysis.news. He's the founder and host of theanalysis.news, a video and audio current affairs interview and commentary show and website. Jay was the founder of the Real News Network and is currently working on a documentary series with Daniel Ellsberg based on Ellsberg's book, The Doomsday Machine. Paul Jay, welcome to Law and Disorder.
Thanks for inviting me.
We want to talk to you today about the continuing unraveling of the cover-up of the Saudi Arabian government's involvement with the attacks of 9/11. President Biden was told by the families of the victims of 9/11 that he would be unwelcome at ceremonies honoring the 20th anniversary unless he released a six-year-old FBI investigative report. He did so. What did the report reveal?
Well, first of all, let me sort of congratulate both of you, because most journalists and other people in the media don't want to even look into what really happened on 9/11. And maybe we can talk about why that is. It's a topic worth discussing in itself. And let me just add one more thing of sort of context here about why all this matters. Like, why are we revisiting the Saudi role, and why, you know, 20 years later is 9/11 significant? And the answer is probably obvious, but let me state it anyway. I don't know if there's been an American war that didn't begin with a bunch of big lies or to establish pretext for what were almost always, or perhaps always, wars of aggression. You can even go back to the beginnings of the Cold War and the lies that there was a missile gap. The Soviet Union was planning to attack the United States, which was all a fraud. Gulf of Tonkin in Vietnam, and it goes on from there. And more recently, and obviously, the lies about weapons of mass destruction in Iraq. American wars begin based on lies. Now, the other thing, and this goes along with lying, is I don't know, has there ever been a war anybody or any country waged that wasn't a conspiracy? Countries don't come out and say, openly say everything they plan to do or how they plan to engage in the war. So this idea that there's something outlandish about conspiracy theory is the most ridiculous thing that's been out there in the politics and media. Of course there are conspiracies attached with warfare and other things. I mean, but there are also phony conspiracies. And yes, there are conspiracy theories that have no basis in fact. But what's a bigger conspiracy than lying about weapons of mass destruction in Iraq when they knew there weren't any? And there were many people involved in that conspiracy, and it came out that it was a conspiracy. Now, that's the other side of all of this. There's no accountability for what happened, lying the United States into an illegal war invasion of Iraq. But of course there was a conspiracy to try to fake evidence and so on, anywhere from the supposed yellow cake story in Niger, you know, trying to lean on the ambassador to lie about what he found. And I mean, it goes on and on. So the fact that there was, a conspiracy in the surrounding and part at the heart of the events of 9/11, it's kind of ridiculous to say otherwise. You can't get a bunch of hijackers coordinating their activities on airplanes without it being a conspiracy. But obviously, I think it goes much further than that, which means the involvement of the Saudi government and the involvement of the White House. So with all that being said, let me talk a bit about this recent reveal or supposed reveal in that declassified FBI document. I'm not completely in the weeds on this whole issue as much as I used to be. So I've read through the recent FBI document. So I may have missed something, but I don't see anything in this FBI document that wasn't already released by the Joint Congressional Investigation into the events of 9/11 that was released in 2002, co-chaired by Senator Bob Graham, who I interviewed. Almost everything that I saw in this recent FBI document, even though it's dated, based on an interview with somebody who they don't say who in 2015, when you read the 28 pages that were originally redacted by the White House of the Joint Congressional Investigation, the entire story that I see in this recent FBI release is all there in 2002, and it's based on FBI documents, which means the FBI had all this stuff years ago. What sparked this release now is the 9/11 families are suing the Saudi government. And I can understand why they wanted this document declassified. It's harder, perhaps harder evidence than the conclusions of the joint congressional investigation. But it actually doesn't say anything new about the involvement of Saudi officials in the Saudi embassy, the Saudi consulate in Los Angeles. What's missing, and this is really critical, what's missing, because in the media coverage of the FBI, this recent FBI document, they don't talk about the most important thing because it's not in that FBI document, or it is, and it's redacted because there's a lot of names redacted in this recent release. But the name is Bandar, Prince Bandar, the Saudi ambassador to the United States, whose nickname, if everybody remembers, was Bandar Bush. And there's this famous photograph of President Bush and Ambassador Bandar, Prince Bandar, sitting on the terrace of the White House just a few days after 9/11, smoking cigars and frankly looking very pleased with themselves. So the media coverage of this recent release, it's kind of ridiculous, at least the mainstream media that I've seen, that they don't hearken back to the conclusions of the Joint Congressional Committee, and most importantly, that this activity of these couple of people in the Saudi consulate in Los Angeles and so on, that this recent release talks about, that clearly you put that together with what the Joint Congressional Committee found, and it's all done under the auspices of Bandar. This isn't some rogue characters. And what the FBI found, it's mentioned in this recent one, but it's even more elaborated in the Joint Congressional Committee, as these two guys particular, and Barumi, I believe, is one, and the other one's Bassan, in all likelihood, according to the FBI and many sources of theirs, they're agents of the Saudi intelligence services. And they're directly connected with facilitating the 9/11 hijackers, particularly or specifically in San Diego. And there's lots of evidence of a direct involvement. But it goes further. If you go back to the Joint Congressional Committee, there's direct links between Prince Bandar and these guys. One of them's wives was receiving, I think it was $2,000 or $3,000 a month from Bandar's wife. There's a direct payment in the redacted 28 pages, a direct payment between Bandar's bank account and one of the two people mentioned in this recent report. I think it was Bassan got some money directly, and then Bassan's wife. Why the mainstream media isn't using this as an opportunity to really not just go after the Saudis, which is honestly so obvious that the Saudis were involved. But, I guess we'll get into this, but clearly a direct line of connection to Cheney and Bush.
Paul, you interviewed Senator Bob Graham some years ago. He was in an important position to learn about the Saudi Arabian involvement. Who's Bob Graham, and what did he tell you?
Yeah, I mean, the real significance of Graham's interview is less about the Saudis and more about the role of Bush and Cheney. First of all, Senator Bob Graham was the chair of the Senate Intelligence Committee for many years. He previously was governor of Florida. He's the co-chair of the Joint Congressional Investigation into 9/11. the one I was just mentioning. They were at this for, I don't know, close to a year. They had millions of dollars to and a team of investigators. So what I'm about to tell you that Graham told me is not the views of some crackpot individual or even rational individual. This is a guy who had a whole team of investigators looking into this stuff. He told me what went far beyond what's in the 28 pages and the official report. I'm not sure why. There are other people that had to sign on to that report, including Nancy Pelosi, by the way, signed that joint congressional report. People were aware. Now, that the report does not talk about the role of Bush and Cheney. It talks about the Saudis. So there's nothing new. Pelosi and others in leadership, both on the Republican and Democratic side, and they all know this stuff. But what he told me that isn't in the report, in answer to my question, I said to him in the first in a series of interviews, I've interviewed him about, I don't know, 7-8 times now altogether. In the first series of interviews, which I think take place in 2010, if my memory serves me right, I said, do you think there was a deliberate attempt by President Bush and Vice President Cheney to create a culture within the intelligence agencies of not wanting to know? And I explained to him several examples of intelligence that had been generated prior to 9/11 that, if acted on, could have prevented 9/11. In fact, Graham actually wrote a book about this, and he had a list of 10 reasons to impeach President Bush. Number one, failing to prevent 9/11. Anyway, his first answer to me was, if all the players on a football team are running in the same direction, there's got to be a coach. Well, the first time I interviewed him, he was a little bit restrained how far he would go. But after the declassification of the 28 famous 28 pages, for people that don't know this story, this congressional report, there were 28 pages the White House insisted were redacted. It's in those pages you get very specific information about the Saudis and the role of Prince Bandar. Well, after a lot of pressure from the 9/11 families, again, they're the ones that have really forced this question out into the open, or as open as it is. These 28 pages were declassified by Obama, but still with a lot of redactions. But once they were released, Graham felt a lot freer to talk. And I said to him, I actually played back that part of the interview where he talked about a football team and a coach. I said, listen, who's the coach? And he says, President Bush and Vice President Cheney. He says, I said, you're saying they deliberately disorganized the intelligence committee. I may not have used exactly those words, but more or less. And he said, yes, but it goes further than that. He said they did some acts that directly facilitated the 9/11 attacks, not just suppressed intelligence. And I'll get into my interview with Thomas Drake about how the intelligence got suppressed, although I asked Graham about this too. But listen to these examples. They're outstanding, outrageous, I guess is the word. He gave me two or three examples of facilitating. Number one, this famous memo, Bin Laden plans to attack America. That is all the, you know, was talked about a lot at the 9/11 hearings. It was read out, you know, on television during those hearings. Condoleezza Rice claims they're a historical document. Ridiculous. After Tenet and Richard Clark, Tenet head of the CIA and Clark the anti-terrorism czar, after they're saying their hair was on fire all summer, telling Condoleezza Rice something's coming, then she thinks this is a historical document, which is a joke. Anyway, so the document goes to Rice and Bush. Well, Graham tells me that the normal protocol is after the presidential briefing, there's another briefing goes out. It's called the principals briefing. It goes to heads of agencies and undersecretaries of certain departments. And any information that's in the presidential briefing that might require action by any agency shows up in the principal's briefing. Well, Bin Laden plans to attack America, you would think, might require some action. So in the next principal's briefing, Graham tells me, it's omitted. And he took this, and he believes that this was a conscious effort to stop, for example, the FAA putting the airports on heightened alert or immigration on higher alert. Number two, never mind putting immigration on higher alert. Now, by the way, I have all this on camera. You can go to the analysis.news. I have all the Graham interviews up there. Graham tells me, far from putting immigration on alert about potential terrorists coming in and potential Saudis, it's the opposite. Graham tells me that the White House issued orders to immigration not to stop any Saudi citizen from entering the United States. Any. They get in without questioning. One guy, according to Graham, one immigration officer in Miami, stopped a Saudi that Graham's investigators concluded was actually meant to be one of the hijackers. He did stop him because he hadn't read the memo and was actually disciplined for not reading the memo. It goes on. Number three, people that followed this story, it's 20 years now, so people probably forget that within just a few days of 9/11, when the airspace of the United States, if memory serves me right, is still closed to at least commercial aircraft, a whole plane load of Saudis is allowed to leave, including many members of the Bin Laden family. Graham told me there are many people on that plane that his committee would have wanted to interview as part of their investigation into 9/11 and couldn't. And when they asked the Saudi government to allow them to be interviewed, they were told no. So there's other examples, too, Graham told me about. So it wasn't just a suppression.
Paul, you interviewed a top official in the National Security Administration, the NSA, and I'm talking about the whistleblower Tom Drake. What did you learn from him?
Well, this is the sort of key that unlocks the dynamic how all this worked. And Graham essentially confirmed what Drake told me. And let me just put this again into a little context, because people are sitting here listening to all this, and you know, why would they do all of this? Well, the why, I think, is obvious. It was all about preparing American public opinion for the invasion of Iraq. And it's, if you go back to the document, the Project for New American Century, which a bunch of neocons wrote as a sort of letter to Clinton, and that group of neocons that wrote that document, including Rumsfeld, Wolfowitz, they formed the whole team around the Secretary of Defense. And of course, Cheney was a signatory to that document. In that document, it says two things, and this is the key to the why, and then I'll get to Drake. Number one, American people, I should say, will not support another major military intervention. And then number two, will not support a massive buildup of the American military, which means large amount of money, an increase in the Pentagon budget, without, and I'm quoting here, another Pearl Harbor. Now, people that follow this story are well aware of this document, but a lot of people are not, especially younger people. Well, it's kind of obvious. 9/11 became the Pearl Harbor, and it was the invasion of Iraq, and it wasn't just about Iraq. I think this is the critical issue. And to understand the Saudi interest here and the American interest, the ultimate prize was regime change in Iran. And in this document and other things that were written by these neocons, the agenda was overthrow Saddam in Iraq, overthrow Assad in Syria, and that's to prepare the conditions for regime change in Iran, plus a massive buildup, meaning a massive expenditure to the military-industrial complex. All right, so that's the motivation here. And of course, the Saudis are as interested in regime change in Iran, or even more than the Americans are, at least may still be, but certainly back then. All right, Drake. Drake was one of the American global leading minds in cybersecurity, dealing with digital data, and was hired by the NSA. And ironically, coincidentally, his first day of work was 9/11. And the morning he goes there, the attacks take place in later that day. But within a week or two, a couple of analysts come to see him. Now, he's very senior. He's a senior executive, reports directly to the number three person in the leadership of the NSA. So that's a very senior position. A couple of analysts come see him a couple of weeks after the attack, and they show him, and they say, and this is Drake telling me again this on camera, "We had the whole thing. They had intercepted, according to Drake, the NSA had intercepted phone calls between all but three of the hijackers and an Al-Qaeda safe house in Yemen. And the entire plot was known. They had recorded, intercepted telephone conversations and knew the whole thing." And the analyst came to Drake and said, "This is crazy. We told the leadership of the NSA, and nothing was done with it." So Drake has told me this on camera. He has actually seen the documentation of the intercept. And then I say to him, "Well, this doesn't make any sense. The leadership of the NSA, even if Bush Cheney had kind of created this culture the way Graham talked about, of not prioritizing terrorism and so on, even if that, there's no way they sit on something like this. They couldn't take the responsibility." And he said, "Of course not." He says there was a back channel to Cheney. And this is the kind of other kind of secret of understanding how they did this. George Tenet testified at the 9/11 commission hearings, that in his first presidential briefing, he told Bush the number one threat to national security is bin Laden and Al-Qaeda. Now, let's remember, on the FBI most wanted list, bin Laden had been number one for the previous 5 years. He was not some unknown quantity that just showed up on 9/11. The FBI already knew he was involved in the Cole attack, the attacks on the Cole Navy ship. Whatever they knew about him, it was enough to say he's number one on the FBI most wanted list. Okay? Tenet confirms he and Al-Qaeda number one threat to national security. So what is one of Bush's first moves dealing with national security? He demotes the anti-terrorism czar, Richard Clark. Richard Clark under Clinton was a cabinet level position. He could call the principal, remember the principals, he could call a meeting of the principals on his own. He didn't have to go through Condoleezza Rice. He gets demoted by Bush and now reports to Condoleezza Rice and testifies at the 9/11 hearings that he couldn't get a meeting of the principals called, even though the quote from him and others, but I think it was Clark's quote, "My hair was on fire. There was so much intelligence coming in." Now, there was a lot of intelligence coming in, Clark was aware of, but some of the most critical intelligence he wasn't aware of. And for example, and this is a little piece of video which I keep playing every time I do a report on this. And I have to say here, I've offered everything I've got to mainstream media over and over again with no interest whatsoever, including my interviews with Clark and Drake. And I'm not like an unknown quantity here, even if they think, I've been working in more independent, marginalized media. I come from CBC in Canada. I was the executive producer of the main political affairs debate show daily for 10 years. I've made documentary films for all the major broadcasters in the world. So I'm not completely marginal character, although I think they have tried to make me so. But at any rate, nobody's been interested in all this stuff I've got. Drake, there's a critical piece of video with Richard Clark. I don't know if he was drinking or what. He was interviewed by two university students. And he said the San Diego cell in California that the FBI knew about and never told the CIA, and the CIA knew about and never told the FBI. The 9/11 Commission depicted that as if it was like Keystone Cops. So they wouldn't even talk to each other. Clark says, I was deliberately bypassed. The CIA, neither the CIA or FBI told me about the San Diego cell. And he says there's absolutely no way that happens. And I have him saying this on camera. Without a deliberate, conscious decision not to tell me, the anti-terrorism czar, who's supposed to be the central repository for all of this information. And what Drake adds to this is that they did report, but to Cheney. And what Cheney did is he got all the intelligence agencies to report to him, including military intelligence that also had pre-9/11 intelligence that could have prevented the attacks. And he just sat on it. He just would let the information flow in, and he would give no instructions to any of the agencies to act. Quite the contrary, as I said earlier, he actually helped facilitate it in other ways.
What do you think was known by the intelligence community, specifically that part of the community that reported to Vice President Dick Cheney before the events of 9/11? Is there evidence that he manipulated the intelligence and set up a back channel?
Let me answer first of all by saying, I know from the people I've interviewed, most importantly, Graham and Thomas Drake, to some extent also John Kerouac and some others, but those two are the key. They're awfully credible sources. As I said earlier, Graham was the chair of the Senate Intelligence Committee, Drake a senior executive at the NSA. So I don't have any ability to have my own investigators. I can't subpoena anybody. What I can say is what I've been told by them. And they say, without doubt, that's what happened. That Richard Clark is on the record saying that he was bypassed on critical intelligence. And it was reported, and Drake says it's reported to Cheney. The inference from Clark is it was reported to Cheney. And one of the arguments that's given about why the administration didn't focus on terrorism, and why even after being told by George Tenet that terrorism was the number one threat to national security, and it's this deprioritization is the reason that there was such chaos amongst the intelligence agencies. Like, for example, there's this Colleen Rowley story. If people remember, she's an FBI agent, I think, in Minnesota. She gets a phone call from a flight school, and the guy who teaches, he says, I've got this guy from the Middle East, and he wants to learn how to take off, but he doesn't want to know how to land. So she finds this suspicious. She sends this to FBI headquarters, and then she asks for a warrant to go into the guy's computer, and it's denied. She later becomes one of the Time Magazine People of the Year as a whistleblower. She's completely credible. This had been explained as this is part of the FBI and others taking a lead from Bush Cheney of deprioritizing terrorism and prioritizing big state actors, meaning Russia and China. And there's always this talk that Condoleezza Rice didn't focus on this because her background was about Soviet Union and Russia, and that's what they were concerned about, and they just didn't think terrorism was a big deal and all this. It's such obvious BS, because we know now from many sources, including Richard Clark's book and Gates' book and others, their priority wasn't Russia and China. Their priority was Iraq from day one. Within days of the attack of 9/11, Bush is telling both the CIA and the Pentagon, get ready for Iraq, focus on Iraq. It was never even about Afghanistan. That became a requirement to attack and invade Afghanistan when it just came obvious to everybody bin Laden had operated out of Afghanistan. And that's a whole nother story, which I can get into. As you know, I made a film about Afghanistan because there's all this talk about that the Taliban wouldn't hand over bin Laden. And that's the reason for invading Afghanistan, which is actually not true. If you want to know more, I've actually interviewed a member of the Central Council of the Taliban. And in fact, they were ready to hand over bin Laden. So the evidence of the back channel is based on Drake Graham. It's based on Richard Clark saying was bypassed on critical intelligence. And there's a certain logic. I mean, is it really possible? And this is where you get a need for an inquiry. Because, yeah, what I'm about to say is not like hard evidence. But, God, a lot of people have been convicted of murder on a lot less circumstantial evidence than what I'm about to say, which is it possible that all the intelligence agencies that had so much pre-9/11 intelligence that could have stopped the attacks, that they just sat on it? I mean, is that possible? If it didn't go to Richard Clark and he claims it didn't, they just, all of them decided, oh, I'm not going to tell. There's one of the military intelligence. This is a report Jason Leopold worked on. And I released on video a lot of his report. The Joint Military Intelligence actually was asked to model in the year early 2001, late 2000, what might another terrorist attack look like? And they modeled, get this, they modeled planes get hijacked, flown into the World Trade Center, and the buildings fall down. They modeled this before 9/11 and did a PowerPoint explaining their modeling. And they gave that up to chain of command. Now, when the leadership of the military intelligence was called before the Joint Congressional Committee and asked, did you have anything that indicated that these attacks might take place? And they said no. So the guy that led the military intelligence team was furious. And he made a report to the Inspector General of the Army, saying, it's not true. We actually had modeled exactly what happened. And we have a PowerPoint. And he sent the PowerPoint to the Inspector General. Well, the Inspector General comes back and says, all the leadership of the intelligence did nothing inappropriate. So this guy's furious, and he leaks the stuff to Jason Leopold. And I think the other guy's name was Jeffrey Kay, I think, something like that. And they actually did the guy himself, the guy from military intelligence, does a FOIA request to the Inspector General to get his PowerPoint. And he gets it. And you can go to my site. I have it too. We actually have Jason had the actual Inspector General's report with a stamp on his PowerPoint explaining how planes are going to hit the buildings and the buildings fall down. So is it really possible that so many intelligence agencies just sit on this information without passing it up somewhere? It's just impossible. So yeah, it's a kind of a supposition, but I think it's enough as a supposition that there still needs to be an independent inquiry into what really happened, because the truth of this has not come out. And it's, as I say, this isn't just a problem of some history. This is a problem of such deliberate lying about 9/11, deliberate lying into the Iraq war. And, you know, are we going to see it again? And this time, if Trump had had his way, in fact, if Bush Cheney hadn't been blocked by the Pentagon, in all likelihood, we would have seen another example, except this time they'll try to pin it on the Iranians.
You interviewed retired Colonel Lawrence Wilkerson, who was Secretary of State Colin Powell's chief of staff prior to 9/11. What did you learn from Wilkerson? How does he feel about the speech Powell gave at the United Nations promoting the attack on Iraq?
Well, first of all, he feels culpability himself. And he went along with what he had by then come to know wasn't true. And Powell's thing about Scud missiles, surrounding Beirut, armed with biological weapons pointed at Israel, he knew this wasn't this. This was being a lot of what Powell said there was being manufactured. And it's, one of the, not one of, the greatest regret of his life that he didn't quit before that speech. I just, let me add a little note of my own. It's my belief that if they actually believed any of what they said at the UN, they wouldn't have invaded. You don't invade a country that has Scud missiles with biological weapons aimed at Israel. That's a pretty good deterrent. You don't risk it. And also, you look at the pictures of American soldiers driving across Iraq towards Baghdad. almost none of them are wearing masks. Anyway, we know the whole thing was a big lie. And Wilkerson, he once said, he said it to me, and I think he said it elsewhere, the people that, Powell and Bush and Cheney, Rumsfeld, are war criminals. And that he said, if they go to jail, I probably need to go with them. I've interviewed him many times now, and I believe he's sincere in this. The other most important thing about how sincere he is, he's almost the only one, and maybe the only one, but certainly one of the only ones, who didn't cash in on all this. All the other people are millionaires, multimillionaires. They all got jobs in the military-industrial complex. They're fabulously wealthy, and he certainly could have been. All he had to do was keep his mouth shut. He could have even just, resigned and not said anything. But instead, he's become, one of the harshest critics of U.S. foreign policy and of the military-industrial complex. And I know he lives quite modestly. He had a professor's salary. He got a job teaching afterwards. But nothing compared to what he could have been. I'm sure he's very smart and understands geopolitics, easily could have been on the board of some big arms manufacturer. But basically what he said, the essence of it is how banal the whole motivation was. There was even less about the geopolitics of regime change in Iraq, Syria, Iran, which it was, but it was more about money making. We know that Dick Cheney and his ties to Halliburton, he was CEO of Halliburton. He still owns stock, in a blind trust, supposedly, after he became vice president. But Halliburton got a no-bid $7 billion contract just days prior to the invasion of Iraq. In fact, there's a woman named Bunny Greenhouse who oversaw contracts for the Pentagon. She's a civilian and looking for, things that are wrong. And she actually reported to the inspector general that why was this a no-bid contract? Because there's at least three, four other companies that could have done the same work, which is restructuring the Iraqi oil industry after the invasion. I mean, that's what they were focused on, the grabbing the oil. And she reported that this contract, and she also reported that this contract was being directly navigated by Rumsfeld's office, which was completely out of the norm. Normally it would come out of some normal Pentagon acquisition office. She was demoted. She was put into some job where she had absolutely nothing to do. She never got promoted again, never got a wage increase, and actually sued the Pentagon later and won. She actually won almost $1 million in a lawsuit over the Cheney-Halliburton contract. It was about money. And it's always about more than one thing. It's not like the geopolitics doesn't matter, but even the geopolitics is mostly about money making. And that's Wilkerson's main theme. And of course, in talking to him, we've all also, and Ellsberg, who I've been talking to, we also learn about the whole nuclear weapons plant is mostly about money too, except there they can end life on Earth.
Do you believe the 9/11 attack was a pivotal point in U.S. and world history?
Yes. I mean, in one obvious way, it was, because it became the rationale for a massive expenditure in the Pentagon, as I said, but also a massive growth in the national security state. You know, from the Patriot Act to the NSA spying on everyone, it became a justification for unmitigated spying on Americans, and certainly everyone else in the world, too. You know, the kind of safeguards that had existed, everything gets thrown out, you know, torture is allowable. And of course, the most important thing is the invasion of Afghanistan and Iraq. Hundreds of thousands of people died. Millions of people were displaced. One of the great war crimes since World War II, maybe the greatest war crime since World War II, Vietnam War, I guess, is the biggest war crime. But after Vietnam, you've got Iraq. But it created, not just even in the United States, it created a rationale for this great strengthening of the national security states in most states, if not all of states. But the other thing it did, which doesn't get talked about enough, is that the media was intimidated. And I think it's one of the most important points of 9/11, that the media has been intimidated looking into what really happened on 9/11. The media was intimidated in playing ball with the lead up to the war in Iraq. Quote from Dan Rather, you know, the former CBS anchor. But unfortunately, he said this to the BBC, and he didn't say it in the U.S. But he said, after 9/11, if you critiqued the White House, it was like, and I'm quoting him, I think, pretty directly, it's like having a flaming tire of patriotism put around your neck. And this is using an example of what happened in the South African townships. If they thought somebody was working with the police, they would set a flaming tire around somebody's neck. That was the ability of the White House. Now, George Bush, President Bush, prior to 9/11, there was a television show on ABC, network TV, called That's My Bush. It was a parody of the Bush family, directly. He was held in such contempt that you could actually have a mainstream TV show ridiculing the Bush family. Well, after 9/11, all of a sudden, he's a hero. That show goes off the air, and the media plays ball. Now, I'm not saying there's no media that wasn't critical. I would give McClatchy some props, is that the word? They didn't buy the whole weapons of mass destruction argument, but we know the New York Times did, and almost the entire network television did. And it hasn't changed that much. 9/11 changed the media culture to a large extent. It's not they were always fantastic. I look at how much trouble and difficulty it was to get the Pentagon Papers. But it did get out, the Pentagon Papers, Ellsberg's thing. Finally, the newspapers had the guts finally to do it. But it took a hell of a long time for the mainstream media to deal with the lies about the Iraq War. And they still haven't dealt with the lies of 9/11. So, yeah, it's a very pivotal event in many ways. But let me focus on that, is that this all the wars, every one of them, is the whole history of national security state, of U.S. militarism, is mostly a fabric of lies. And people just don't get it. I mean, in the schools, of course, it's never really exposed. And the media that does it, like yours or mine or some others that do get at this stuff, you know, we get so marginalized that they don't really care that we can, you know, poke through the fabric of Americanism. You know, once in a while, events tear the shredding of the Americanism, but it doesn't take long for the media to bring, you know, close ranks again.
Paul Jay, thank you very much. We truly, truly appreciate your fine investigative reporting on this is what is probably the biggest story of the last part of our lifetime. We truly, truly appreciate your fine investigative reporting on this is what is probably the biggest story the last part of our lifetime.
Thanks, Michael. Yeah, you can find me at theanalysis.news, And it needs theanalysis.news. It needs the.
People will go to theanalysis.news to fill in what you haven't had a chance to tell us. Thank you so much, Paul Jay, for your extremely important work. We truly appreciate your being on Law and Disorder.
Thank you, Paul.
Thanks very much.
If you have any comments or questions about this segment or any others, please visit us at lawanddisorder.org. That's lawanddisorder.org. One word, lawanddisorder.org.
DJ Heim from Forest, and you're listening to 88.3 WRCT.
Hi, we're the 1985, and whenever we're in Pittsburgh, Pennsylvania, we like to pick up 13-year-old runaways at the Greyhound station and listen to WRCT! Woo!
You're listening to WRCT Feedback Radio.
Yeah, well, this is Kimani Mali, and you're listening to WRCT-FM. Keep it locked, Rasta.
My fellow Americans, I would just like to say now, as an expert on the subject, that WRCT Pittsburgh does not blow. Thank you.
WRCT Pittsburgh, we love monkeys.
Soon, pay toilets will take over the world, and everyone, everywhere will listen to WRCT Pittsburgh, 88.3 FM.
Top dog in Pittsburgh, WRCT.
WRCT Pittsburgh, music for your inner robot.
You're listening in at your house, or you're listening in at your car. If you want to hear good music, you don't have to go far. 88.3 is the magic number. WRCT in the Pittsburgh area. Who say so? I say so. Who is me? Maccabee Selassie.
We'll give you total control over our lives. Everyone shuts the hell up.
We're Hydra! WRCT! Pittsburgh!
You're listening to WRCT, Friends of the FCC. Good friends, good times, and eggnog.
WRCT Pittsburgh. No one is as excited about flaming cheese as we are.
WRCT Pittsburgh, meaty and full.
Aisha Collins from Late Show with David Letterman, and you are listening to WRCT Pittsburgh.
Beijing's Belt and Road Initiative is a gigantic economic plan to try and transform their world and create a link to Europe that is not dependent on anyone else. And they're operating like a major economic power that they have become. The question arises, who regards this initiative as a threat? The United States is deeply hostile to it.
That's Tariq Ali, and this is Alternative Radio. I'm David Barsamian. This edition of AR features Tariq Ali on Afghanistan, China, and the decline of U.S. power. Part 1 of a special two-part program. The ignominious debacle in Afghanistan was predictable and predicted. Afghans, like most people, don't appreciate foreign invaders occupying their country. Just ask the British and the Russians. But the U.S. in its imperial hubris thought it was different. It would nation-build in Afghanistan and bring democracy to that land. Meanwhile, China is watching the U.S. squander its wealth on military adventures. The decline of U.S. power is evident. In its place, China is rapidly expanding its influence. Its Belt and Road Initiative is an ambitious global infrastructure project, a new Silk Road. China, as the quip goes, had a bad couple of centuries of wars, invasions, famine, and disease. But now it is back. It is a force to be reckoned with. Its economic clout is increasing, and it will soon be the world's biggest economy. Our guest today is Tariq Ali, an internationally renowned writer and activist who was born in Lahore, Pakistan. For many years, he's been based in London, where he is an editor of New Left Review. He's the author of many books, including The Clash of Fundamentalisms, Pirates of the Caribbean, Speaking of Empire and Resistance, and The 40-Year War in Afghanistan, a chronicle foretold. He was at his home in London when I talked with him on September 9th and 10th. Welcome to the program.
Very good to be with you again, David, after all these years. We've had a big interval in our regular conversations.
Well, you and I are both very fond of poetry. Here's a couplet from Yeats that I'm sure you're familiar with. We had fed the heart on fantasies, the heart's grown weary from the fair. I want to segue that into a discussion about Afghanistan and the fantasies that we've fed ourselves over the decades. Where's a good place to start, by the way, with Afghanistan? 1978, 1979?
Yeah. Two things, David. When the PTPA, basically a small group of Afghan communists who were placed in strategic positions inside the army and the air force, decided that the then President Daoud, a relation of the king, Zahir Shah, was becoming too dictatorial and too closely linked to the Shah of Iran, they decided to seize power, which they did. They characterized this as a revolution, which I argued even at that time wasn't the case. I said, effectively, it's a coup d'etat carried out by left-wing army officers, as has happened in parts of the Middle East, but happened in the Middle East with huge mass support. It was obvious when it happened in Iraq, in Egypt before that.